Good morning, such as it is. This is Uncle Don again, here to read the comics. Okay, not Uncle Don, not the comics. Some serious stuff and some fluff. Here goes. This is CFUR 88.7 on your FM dial. This show is dedicated to World Youth Day. This is the day when Toronto will be spending upwards of $10 million for security and cleanup for a big party for kids who believe in miracles. The city is playing host to the leader of these kids. He is an old Pole who emigrated to lead the only country in the world still ruled entirely by men. You cannot miss him. He will be the guy in the robes with the hat that looks like a hungry barnacle riding around in an air-conditioned, bulletproof wheelchair with Vatican plates. What I cannot understand is this. If there are miracles in answer to prayers, why isn't this old Pole jogging instead of having his sick carcass driven around the city with doctors hovering over him? Isn't anyone praying for him? Before I begin my ranting for today, I want to clarify something. I am not in favor of violent revolution in either the United States or Canada. As one trained in economics, I will add, of course, ceteris paribus. This means other things remaining equal. However much we might need to throw out the system that is destroying our countries and the world, who could mount a revolution now in either country? Those with the organization and or the guns. Who might this be? The socialists? The scientists? The rationalists? The anarchists? We know who is organized most effectively now. These are the religious freaks who can get hundreds of followers out on short notice to picket a clinic that gives abortions. These are the fundamentalists who will vote according to the orders of some fire-breathing preacher who tells them that unions are evil and that unfettered capitalism is the master plan of the sky god. Those of us who are not in thrall of some religion are generally too busy with our real lives to drop everything and march to someone else's drum. And we are too critical to believe that someone has an automatic mandate to tell us how to vote or what to think. As for the guns and the training to use them, they are largely in the hands of the military, the militias, and the National Rifle Association types. The military is trained to think that there is a violent answer to any problem. It comes with the job. If we look at countries in the world where the military has taken control from a democratic government, we cannot find a single example where human rights were improved. Military coups are invariably bloodbaths and the innocent suffer. The militias are all nutcases, often ex-military, who have a simple answer to every question. Beware of these armed and dangerous loonies. Then there is the NRA and its clone here in Canada. These good folks overlap with the militia types but are usually more reasonable. But talk to a dedicated member and you will usually find some right-wing type that wants freedom for himself and oppression for anyone different. If I thought there were a Che Guevara or Fidel Castro in the hills, I would be with them in spirit, if not in body. Ah, but Che was murdered and Fidel is a member of the Axis of Evil, right? Too much television and not enough travel. I've been to Cuba 6 times and I know from experience that the news we get about that island is largely filtered by the United States and is, in a word, largely bullshit. No paradise there, but what do you expect for a country that has been under attack for 4 decades by the most powerful country on earth? You want to find out about Cuba? Go there. But don't sit on a beach in Varadero and expect to come back an expert. See the countryside. Best of all, hitchhike around the country. Yes, that can be done and is being done right now by a lot of young people of all ages. But I digressed. We have no national heroes in the wings in either Canada or the U.S. who would fight for a better land for all of us. Even if we did, now the technology is such that no one can take to the hills and not be found. With the satellite technology they have, they can find you if you blow a warm fart and then drop a smart bomb on your hat. No, violent revolution is out of the question. The hope that I have is that concerned, rational citizens of Canada, to hell with the U.S. for now, will use the tattered remnants of democracy that we still have to change the system from within the system. It will not be easy. It will not be fast. Those with the money and the power will not give up either easily. They have the police, the military, the so-called justice system, and they have the propaganda organs. As long as they have the newspapers, the television, the radio, except for CFUR, Canada's favorite university radio at 88.7 FM, the movies, the music industry, and other molders of opinion, we will have an uphill battle getting through to the average person who is struggling to keep it together in the system as it is now. We can all do our part. The alternative is surrender to the insipid culture of consumerism, entertainment, and trying to find a personal niche in a system of predatory capitalism. You choose. This is a great season for nostalgia. Some people call it retro and buy hideous lava lamps. This confuses nostalgia with nausea. Others look forward in different way, look backward in different ways. Russia has a growing number of citizens who long for the days of the Soviet Union, when consumer goods might have been scarce, but where everyone had a job, there were no homeless, social services were provided for everyone, and the country had a sense of pride. The Nicaraguans look back to the heady days before Reagan unleashed his mercenary war criminals to drive the Sandinistas from power. They had pride then and a sense of common purpose. The people had defeated a nasty dictator, and they thought the world was their oyster. The American blacks look back proudly on the days before Nixon and his minions destroyed the Black Panthers for self-defense, who had made blacks hold their heads high. The Panthers united inner-city blacks and stood up to the white controllers while doing subversive things like feeding hungry kids. Canadians are looking back to the days when Canada was a nation with some real sovereignty before Mulroney and Chrétien sold us out to their American masters. Trudeau did some nasty things, but he was a Canadian first, and he dared to stand up to the Americans when he could. And the First Nations here wish that Christopher Columbus had gotten lost somewhere else. There were no honkies around then to hold a referendum on what rights they could have in their own lands. That's nostalgia. I never made it to the Soviet Union in my travels. I regret that. I did have occasion to visit the Soviet embassy in Canberra, though. I went there to ask about travel in the Soviet Union. A bulky receptionist sent me to a spacious office with heavy furniture and a similarly heavy Slavic gentleman in an ill-fitting suit. I told him I wanted to know about hitchhiking in the Soviet Union. "What is hitchhiking?" asked the suit. I tried to explain about asking for rides and all that. I knew that hitchhiking was encouraged in the Soviet Union as an alternative to sparse public transport, but I did not mention that. The suit listened to my explanation and then concluded the interview with the immortal statement, "There are no homeless people in the Soviet Union." Bang, back on the street. If we were watching a movie about Georgie Bush, we could count on the last reel showing that he really has a heart of gold. He would do something heroic to demonstrate that people have misunderstood him and that he has the best interests of the world in as his guiding lights. Sorry, this is the real world. If you believe that George Bush is a good man, it is time for your bingo. Off you go. Now that that crew is gone, let us get down to the reality of the world. Georgie Bush was brought up with money and power. He drank, bought, and probably cheated his way through Yale University and Harvard, achievements which are probably not celebrated by either institution today. He was a failure in the oil business in spite of his father's help and that of his daddy's friends to ease his way. He did, though, manage to salvage a personal fortune out of his failure, not unlike the achievements of the executives of Enron, WorldCom, and others that he is now chastising. He even took a personal loan from his failing company, an act for which he now advocates harsh penalties. As governor of Texas, a position that I suppose he bought, he approved the execution of, I believe, some 130-odd prisoners, many of which were convicted on flimsy evidence. I would say that makes him a serial killer. Harsh judgment? Off to bingo with you. But Georgie has always admired his daddy. You have to give him credit for that. He hung around the White House while his daddy was establishing his credentials as a war criminal for his personal war against the people of Iraq. Now Georgie is a war criminal in his own right for invading Afghanistan on the flimsiest of pretexts. Not that now that he has restored the warlords to power in that benighted land, he is off to new conquests. Georgie wants to finish the job of destroying the civilization of Iraq that his father started a decade ago. Neither Bush had any real quarrel with Hussein. He used to be their boy. George Sr. would not have given a hang for the independence of Kuwait if he had been sure that Hussein would continue to follow orders as he used to. But Bush could not allow an independent leader, democratic or dictator, who would not assure a steady supply of oil to America. Iraq, and, by example, the rest of the world, had to be taught a lesson. Now Iraq has been humiliated, impoverished, blasted, starved, and disarmed. But they still don't follow orders. Resurrect the image of weapons of mass destruction. America must be protected from this rogue state. So now there are not-so-secret preparations for an invasion of Iraq. Allies are being bullied, bribed, and cultivated to give the appearance of an international action. Troops are being sent to new bases, ringing Iraq. Oil companies are preparing to take the spoils of war. Onward, out with the flags, bunting, and the yellow ribbons for America's soon-to-be-fallen heroes. Everyone knows that the invasion of Iraq is planned, but the timing is a mystery. Speculation is focusing on a spring attack, although there are other factors that could intervene. For instance, if it looks like the Republicans might lose valuable congressmen, senators, or governors in the November elections, the drums of war might herald another October surprise to rally the Yanks around a war government. Never change horses in midstream would be the battle cry heard across the land. There is also a possibility that some past crime of Bush's might come to light that is so egregious that it has to be masked with a war. That works, too. What we know is that, barring a miracle, Georgia is going to violate the UN Charter and any number of international laws, but who cares about them when you have the power, and attack another helpless country on the far side of the planet. As Madeleine Albright is reputed to have said, what good is having all of these weapons if you cannot use them? As for me, I rather hope that Bush is right and that Hussein has hidden some weapons of mass destruction and that he can hit Washington with them. I like to root for the underdog. Since Bush wants to finish the job Daddy started in Iraq, it would be poetic justice if Hussein finished the job on the Pentagon that Bin Laden started. Amen. This is CFUR, Canada's favorite university radio at 88.7, and this is Uncle Don reading the comics, so to speak. I have fond memories of the British Columbia Telephone Company. Does anyone remember them? That was way back when the people of Alberta owned their own telephone company, Alberta General Telephone. The government there gave the phone company to their friends, and then it merged with BCTEL, creating the entity calling itself TELUS. TELUS, under the leadership of megalomaniac capitalists, decided it should play in the big kid's sandbox. They borrowed heaps of money and bought into a number of dubious companies caught up in the telecom bubble. Now the bubble has burst. TELUS stock, a lot of it owned by employees who had faith, has tumbled, and the huge debt is in danger of being reclassified to junk bond status. Thanks to the management of TELUS for the tremendous leadership that earned you millions in salary, bonuses, and options. Who's going to pay for TELUS's failures? Well, we can expect our business-friendly BC government to cover part of it in one way or another. The employees are paying through massive layoffs on top of the money they lost by buying company shares. And then that leaves us, the poor schmucks who have to rely on the local and long-distance TELUS services such as they are. I signed up for an offer from TELUS which gives us 240 minutes of off-hour long-distance calling each month for a flat fee. My January bill contained a minute statement that there would be a, quote, long-distance administration fee each month henceforth. The print was so small that I did not notice it until it was brought to my attention when I bitched. It seems that the terms of any agreement can be changed by the company in the company's favor whenever they wish. Sounds like the way our beloved provincial government honors its agreements. The fee is a dollar and a quarter, which is not much, but it amounts to $15 a year for every subscriber who has this agreement. Not too small potatoes when taken in the aggregate. We used to have the CRTC regulate the rates that telephone companies charged. They still do to some extent, as witnessed by the denial of a blanket increase for local calls that the company had asked for. TELUS used that denial as an excuse for firing a good percentage of their employees. Soon we will find that these surplus employees, what they used to do when they are gone, and we want the service that we pay for monthly. And, while a general increase was denied, it looks like TELUS has a blank check to nickel and dime us out of the equivalent amount in other ways, like that buck and a quarter a month. Gee, that sounds like the way Campbell gave us a tax cut and then clawed it back through increased medical premiums and user fees. But I don't want to sound like a cynic, confusing a bunch of greedy capitalists, well, with a bunch of greedy politicians who are stooges for the greedy capitalists. Now, I want to do my bit to increase the number of listeners to this show, as well as give poor Georgie Bush a chance to defend himself. I have invited Georgie to come on this show for an informal debate come interview relating to the things I have been saying about him. This is the letter I just sent him. 16 July 2002, President George W. Bush, the White House, Washington, D.C., USA. Dear Mr. President, on behalf of CFUR Radio at the University of Northern British Columbia, I am inviting you to an interview debate on my show, Uncle Don Reads the Comics. This talk show is devoted to personal anecdotes and my commentary on current events. As Uncle Don, I have been roasting you and your presidency since the program's inception. Now is your chance to defend yourself in front of the good people of my Prince George audience. I suggest 11 September of this year as a good time for our radio show, but this will be a subject for future negotiation. In making your plans, please affirm that the Prince George Airport can handle Air Force One. You might have to take WestJet from Calgary or Vancouver. I can give you a lift from the airport in my pickup. Bring your Secret Service bodyguards if you wish, but they will have to take a taxi to the university. And tell them to leave their guns at home. Guns make Canadians nervous, and weapons are not allowed on university property. We can spring for a hotel room and a couple of meals for you, but again, your toadies and Secret Service men will have to be on their own. Let me give you an idea of what I want to discuss with you in this proposed interview debate. Over the past few weeks, I have implied that, as governor of Texas, you are a serial killer of poor men on death row. I have also talked of your shady business deals while you were in the oil business. And I questioned your wisdom. Well, I did not put it quite that way. I said you were dumb. I also said that you violated international law and the UN Charter by invading Afghanistan to retaliate for an attack by 19 men, none of whom were Afghan. We want to hear more about that. I said that the compensation for this error will be a pipeline in Afghanistan that your oil buddies want. I am sure we can find other matters to bring up, like the phony war on terror and the coming American invasion of Iraq. I'm ready to discuss any or all of these subjects. I am sure that you have position papers and such that you can use to justify all of your actions. My audience is eager to hear your defense. The staff of CFUR and I are looking forward to meeting you in September. Please reply in ample time for us to make final arrangements here. Sincerely yours, etc., etc. I'm not sure that Georgie will be able to make it here on short notice, but I was assured that I can get the required airtime here on CFUR. I like the idea of interviewing the son of a Bush on the 11th of September, but I suspect that we will have to choose a different date since there will be certain ceremonies in the states at which he may have to be present, but dates are flexible. I will advise all of you listeners as to developments as they unfold. Just when I think that Georgie has pushed the envelope as far as possible, in comes another bit of news to blow me away. This one is in the form of an article reprinted from the Sydney Morning Herald, dated 15 July. The headline reads, U.S. planning to recruit 1 in 24 Americans as citizen spies. It tells of a new program named the Terrorism Information and Prevention System, or TIPS, which is about to begin a pilot program next month in 10 U.S. cities. This Department of Justice project is to be part of Bush's war on terrorism. The U.S. government hopes to recruit a minimum of 4% of Americans as a, quote, formal way to report suspicious terrorist activity, unquote. At first, I thought this was another spoof making its way around the Internet, until I checked the website listed in the article, www.citizencorps.gov, and found that this is truly a U.S. government program. They intend to recruit, quote, truckers, letter carriers, train conductors, ship captains, utility employees, and others, unquote, to spy on their fellow citizens. Now when an American has a repairman into his home or receives a letter from a suspicious address, perhaps from someone with an Arabic name like Muhammad Chilali, the Canadian who helped save French President Chirac's bacon, he will never know whether the person with the toolbox or the mailman's uniform is making a phone call that will add his name to a secret list and create a file to be used against him someday. Welcome to the land of the free and home of the brave. Perhaps it is time for the French to ask for their Statue of Liberty back. Enough of Bush. The good news for all of you dope fiends out there is that our very own Justice Minister, Martin Chachon, has stated that it is time to review Canada's antiquated marijuana laws. He wants Canada to fall in line with the British initiative that effectively decriminalizes possession of small amounts of pot. If the Justice Minister has his way, anyone found with a weed joint will have it confiscated and be subject to a stern warning and perhaps a ticket like a traffic ticket. No more criminal records for kids caught with pot so they cannot go to Disneyland. This will, of course, anger the Americans who still throw people in jail for long periods of time for possessing a weed that grows wild. But then, they have that vast prison industry to feed. Faithful listeners will have heard my rant on the subject of the American prison industry last week. I still hold that one of the problems with American society is that too many Americans think that Bud is a beer. Mellow out, Americans. This last Sunday on CBC, Cross Country Checkup spent 2 hours talking about pot. The viewpoints of callers covered the spectrum from criminalization to outright legalization. Uncle Don does not agree with any of these callers or the radio host. I think that marijuana should be made mandatory. If you are worried about keeping kids away from anything, just let them think that it is required. Pretty soon you would have gangs of kids hanging around street corners, visibly straight and dressed in neckties, keeping a keen eye out for the cops. In the 70s, California informally eased up on prosecutions for minor pot possessions. They could not do this up front, as there are too many anal retentive rednecks in Orange County to allow that, but the cops were tired of making fools of themselves in court, swearing solemnly that some kid did, indeed, have a roach in his pocket when apprehended. It was like giving a speeding ticket to a Volkswagen. They hated it. Around this time, an old friend, who was generally stoned, had occasion to test the new flexibility of the law. He was driving his van on the freeway and had just finished a joint when the man pulled up behind him with lights flashing. He figured he had had it. He stopped and rolled down his window to engulf the cop in a haze of smoke that could have given him a buzz right there. The cop said nothing about that, but gave him a ticket for a blown taillight. When he got home, my friend checked his taillights and found they were both working perfectly. I know from experience that pot was freely available in the Prince George Regional Correctional Center when I was there. There's too much traffic in and out of such an institution for even an alert staff to prevent drugs from coming in. And staff grew complacent, if not complicit. If guards came in shift and smelled the sweet aroma of marijuana in the living units, they knew it was going to be an easy shift. They could walk calmly through the units while the prisoners munched potato chips and avidly watched their televisions. If, on the other hand, some ingenious prisoner had managed to make an alcoholic brew from potato peelings, oranges, or whatever, there was going to be trouble. The canteen officer even suggested that marijuana be added to the list of goodies that were available for purchase, but this did not go far. He was a maverick amongst some pretty uptight people. I used to think that I understood the concept of a park. To me, a park was a publicly owned place that was available for the enjoyment of all citizens. It was a protected place, free of commercial intrusions, that had been put aside for the pleasure of present and future generations. It was inviolate, and public usage was to be minimally intrusive and non-destructive. It was a place where anyone could go and enjoy the majesty and peace of unspoiled nature. But that was before our new era of prosperity. A year or two ago, I had occasion to talk with a man from Tofino, just outside the Pacific Rim National Park on Vancouver Island. He used to work for the Park Service there until Mulroney came up with the brilliant idea that our national parks were to become sources of income rather than protected places. He said that he was one of many park rangers who quit in disgust at the prospect of answering to the accountants rather than to the naturalists. Now it seems that our provincial park government has also decided that preservation of wild places for our citizens should not be the goal of parks. The Globe and Mail just had an article under the headline, BC hopes to turn a profit from its parks. The article stated that the so-called liberals have overhauled our 800 parks with a view to making them, quote, more profitable and better used, unquote. It seems that our 77 so-called liberal legislators do not think a tree has any value while vertical, nor that a stream of any worth until it enters a pipe. They have, quote, cut, unquote, 23 camping areas from the inventory, whatever that means, and they want to increase, quote, commercial involvement, unquote, in some 170 parks. According to the article, Joyce Murray, BC's water, land, and air minister, said the province's parks are not generating enough income to sustain themselves in their current form. Does this not beg the question, who says parks are supposed to pay for themselves? When did this law come down on stone tablets? I thought that our taxes in the present were to preserve parks, and we were leaving a legacy for the future. She said that, quote, the province's stunning parks are a gold mine that could be extracting more money from users, unquote. There you have it. This is what a bottom-line government will do to us. Everything for the damn dollar, and those dollars go to the rich. It is a hell of a system for a country that supposedly still has citizens as well as consumers. I recently took a family trip to Jasper by car. When we stopped at the normal pit stops on Highway 16 at Bowron River and Willow River, I found them both closed and in disrepair. Upon returning home, where I wrote to my MLA, Pat Bell, about the rest areas, and he bucked it on to the Fort George District Manager for the Ministry of Transportation, who wrote to me. This manager said that both of these rest areas, quote, have had their toilet facilities closed, unquote, and the two stops were now classed as pull-out locations for traffic. Well, for a government that wants to increase tourism, that is a damn funny way to funny trick to pull. People will continue to stop at these pleasant spots by the rivers, but if the facilities are not maintained, they will be vandalized and filled with garbage and human waste by our less thoughtful citizens. A fine way to greet tourists to British Columbia. Here's a public service announcement. The Uncle Don coffee mugs, pennants, dish towels, neckties, ball caps, and condoms have arrived and are now on display at the University Bookstore at reasonable prices. This is CFUR, Canada's favorite university radio at 88.7 FM. Send irate letters to Uncle Don, care of CFUR, 333 University Way, Prince George, V2N4Z9. Euphemisms. Everybody uses them. No one wants little Janie running into their tea party with the exuberant announcement that she has to take a dump. So we have to devise a code so that she does not say dump, but everyone knows what that she has to do. Who are we fooling? Now little Janie comes in and tells the world that she has to do number two. No wonder kids don't like math. They don't want to wash their hands after doing it. Euphemisms are linguistic pollution. We try to choose a word to avoid a more direct or crude word, and we pollute the new word. Take, for instance, the above example of dump. I remember when a dump was a place where refuse was discarded, and the use of the word never evoked a grin. Now look at it since we chose it as a euphemism. Does anyone out there remember Carrie Jane Gray? She was a city councilor here in Prince George for many years, and she did a lot for the community. They named a park just off Highway 16 for her. Unfortunately, they use a portion of this park for storing snow in the winters, and I was amused to see a sign posted that pointed the way to the Carrie Jane Gray Snow Dump. Thanks a lot, Carrie Jane. We took my grandson to the dentist the other day for his first filling. The dentist was careful to explain to this four-year-old exactly what he was doing so the kid would not be afraid. When he gave the Novocaine shot, he said that he was giving the tooth a drink. The rubber dam was a raincoat, and the filling was a silver star. This was a constructive use of euphemism to serve a good purpose. When euphemisms are used to mask the truth instead of making something understandable, they are destructive. Their use can destroy words that we need to convey thoughts. No longer can I think that I will go home on a cold day and sit before a friendly fire. The military has wrecked that one. I used to think of a debate as a reasoned exchange of viewpoints leading to a conclusion. Then I witnessed Parliament. A campus? That used to be the grounds of an educational institution. Now we have the likes of Microsoft calling its industrial site a campus. And parks. Don't get me started on parks. Enterprise parks from our public parks, indeed. And we also have words from the public domain being appropriated by business. Remember when classic referred to music or ancient civilizations? Not now. The advertising industry has done its Pavlov Act, and now kids drool for carbonated sugar water when the word classic is mentioned. I cannot mention the name of the product here on this campus, as there was a secret deal negotiated with Pepsi to clutter the place with machines dispensing their brand of sugar water at over a buck a crack. In the military, we had Jeeps. They were made by Ford in that batch. They went out to bid, and any company might make them. The name Jeep was an acronym for General Purpose Vehicle. It was not a trade name. Somehow, Willis Overland copyrighted the name, and it became the main item of value that finally ended up in the hands of the Chrysler Corporation. Now they have the audacity to display the brand name of Jeep on their air-conditioned, oversized, gaudy junk that has nothing to do with any general-purpose vehicle. Oh, yeah. And then there's the word sport. It is used on everything from candy bars to the massive pieces of overpriced Detroit iron cluttering our roads and pissing away our precious gasoline. What does sport have to do with SUVs? In fact, what does utility have to do with them? There go two perfectly good English words into the garbage of commercial gobbledygook. At least they are vehicles. I gave up the idea of driving a sport utility vehicle because I no longer have a jockstrap. That's enough for today's show. This is CFUR, 88.7 FM, and this is Uncle Don signing off for another week. I guess that will take care of the little bastards for another week.